The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
From last time, there were a couple of questions we didn't finish. One was the dummy rule, and we said what the dummy rule was. That when an action pattern, an innate motor pattern, can be triggered by a dummy stimulus, an artificial simplified stimulus, okay, you can be sure you're dealing with innate behavior. Why can't it be inverted? Why can't you invert that rule? That means if there is a behavior and you can't elicit it with a dummy stimulus. You can't use a simplified stimulus. Can you then conclude that you're not dealing with a fixed action pattern? What would you say to that?
You might not have a good enough stimulus.
Might not have a good enough stimulus. Why?
It might not be fitting the key characteristics. Or,
but let's assume that if there were key stimuli, certain simplified key stimuli, that you could find them. You know, we know what elicits the behavior in nature, so we should be able to create a dummy stimulus. But yes. Well, that's a problem too, if the readiness to respond were very low. So let's assume the animal hasn't done the behavior for a long time, and so we know its readiness is high. Okay, but the fact is we still can't conclude that it's not a fixed action pattern, simply because for many fixed action patterns, for at least some species, the triggering stimulus is learned, or at least has a heavy learned component, or is modified from the original stimulus that elicits it. And so it can become quite complex. You might not be able to find a dummy stimulus to elicit it. Okay? So that's the answer. Yes?
But if it doesn't respond to the stimulus, can you conclude that it's a complex learned response?
Usually that is the case. Because the usual role of learning for an innate releasing mechanism, let's say there's some key stimuli initially that will elicit, but learning still plays a role. Usually the role learning plays is to make it much more specific. Okay? So the bird responds to its own mother and not somebody else's mother, for example. So it's adding detail. Initially, it may respond to any imprinting is like that. Birds that imprint often do have an innate response. For example, anything about the right size that's moving and that utters a certain call. Some ducks are like that, but the rest is learned. Okay. Yes.
Does this have to do also with you're talking about the transposability of key stimuli? Like maybe with the dummy stimulus, it just doesn't quite have enough of the proper interactions.
You should be able to discover the relationship with key stimuli. You know, all that means, transposability just means that the absolute size, color, shape, and so forth may not be important as long as the relationships are there. But since we see in nature what elicits it, we should be able to do that. I mean, these are rules of thumb. You know, these aren't... That's why we don't call them laws. Okay. Class 10, key concepts from Lawrence. So this is the rest of it. And in that, I'm including a little more on the models, fixed action patterns and IRMs, Lawrence and Tinbergen models primarily, the hierarchy of behavior that was expressed most clearly by Tinbergen. Then we'll talk about spatial orientation by reflexes and in higher animals with the help of an internal model, and then the problem of multiple simultaneous motivations. Motivation is almost never pure. We're usually influenced by two or more motivations at the same time. How do we deal with that? Okay. So my first question was, explain the difference between Lawrence's old mechanical hydraulic model and his revised model. And I have the pictures here. It's not going to help you, but these are the, you remember these pictures from the text? Okay. Now we talked about this once before. I want you to understand what he changed about it. Why is that important? You remember? Anybody remember? What did he change in the model? And by so doing, he made his model different from other models that people were considering. Yes?
He said something that I couldn't quite understand. He put an additional expression. I was trying to understand what he meant. He said that the specific readiness releasing stimuli, and he also said he lowered the threshold of the...
Yeah, he changed the shape a little bit so the water's deeper, but that's all by analogy, you know. That wasn't an important thing. The detail that he changed that's so significant is the how the key stimuli act. Like Tinbergen, he initially had the key stimuli removing a block, something that prevents the pattern from being discharged. Because if there wasn't, the reasoning was that once there's a buildup of this action-specific potential, the innate behavior should sort of dribble out, you know, but it doesn't. So something blocks it. Okay? But he changed that. He assumed that there is a barrier that has to be overcome. That's represented by the spring valve. Okay? But now he has... The stimuli, the key stimuli, are like the same as other inputs to that reservoir of action-specific potential. So now, what has he got contributing to action-specific potential? First of all, the endogenous input. Whatever it is that builds up over time when an animal doesn't show the behavior. Okay. The more I don't blink my eyes, the greater the readiness to blink my eyes builds up. The longer I don't swallow, the greater the readiness to swallow builds up. Okay? In addition, there are other stimuli that affect readiness, and he's realized that, so in the new model he adds several others that also contribute to how fast that builds up. So that's a small change he made. But the big change he made was the key stimuli that seemed to trigger the response do the same thing. They simply add to the readiness to respond. They add to the action-specific potential. But they add it very fast and in large quantity. So he's got a faucet with a lot of volume of water coming out of it in his hydraulic model. And that... At first it seems strange to people, but actually it fits our intuition about our own motivational states, because when you see key stimuli, there may be factors that prevent you from carrying it out, like you see food and you're hungry, but there might be a window between you and the food. What happens? Your appetitive behavior increases. You feel a stronger motivation. And that's true for animals too. And he realized that and put it into his model. And it seems to fit the way natural behaviors occur better than the old model. Okay. More on that, the first topic. the brain stimulation work of von Holst indicated a relationship between the level of the central nervous system that was stimulated and the time course of behavioral effects of stimulation. What are we talking about there? Yes?
So he found that the more integrated the system was that he stimulated, the longer it took for the effects of stimulation to wear off.
That's right. So if you stimulate the behavior and then you remove that brain stimulation, it still lasts for a while. But what was the effect on the level of the nervous system? She said the greater the integration of the behavior, the more complex it was, the longer it took. And similarly, switching from one behavior to the other was slower for these more complicated patterns. So if we go down to a lower level, like the simple movement, flexion of a wrist, that's at a pretty low level, controlled by spinal cord. If we stimulate that, the effect is immediate and it wears off immediately. We switch the stimulus to another area and we'll immediately get the other movement. We won't get this continuing. But at a higher level, if we trigger, you know, feeding behavior, we won't get such a rapid switch. And we don't switch as rapidly from feeding to attack behavior and so forth. And that was a contribution of the neuroscience that fit what Lawrence had observed behaviorally. Can anybody give me examples of the effects of what he calls the inertia of excitation in animal behavior? This means behavior. If behavior has an inertia, that means that if you elicit the behavior with key stimuli, and then you suddenly remove the stimuli that elicited, the behavior doesn't all go away. We just mentioned that. Well, what's an example of that inertia? Somebody else? Yes? That's right. So the fish continued to show the aggressive behavior, but the fish he was aggressing against is gone now. So he aggresses against things that only have a mild resemblance to their fish. You know, parts of the tank he's kept in and so forth. If you, in human behavior, can you think of things like that? If someone is very angry and the person he's angry at slams the door in his face, what is he likely to do? Is his anger going to disappear? The stimulus triggering the anger is suddenly gone. No, he's likely to put his fist through the wall or through the door. He's going to continue to show anger. That's the inertia of these innate behavior patterns. And it certainly applies to humans. Fear shows a lot of inertia like that also. You know, the stimulus eliciting the fear may disappear, and suddenly you feel greater fear towards every shadow. And you find many examples of that in animal behavior and in human behavior. Okay. Yes.
Would post-traumatic disorder be considered as the inertia?
Of which?
Post-traumatic disorder.
Post-traumatic stress disorder. Okay. That's a more complex thing, and I think it would be hard to say that's just related to the inertia of behavior. You know, that's a pretty complex question. I won't try to answer the whole thing now. Though I do think human disorders we get some help in explaining them from studies of animal behavior. And in fact, you get abnormal behavior in animals too. But this thing he's talking about here is more short term. Okay, it's what you see immediately. One more question in that section. I had this divided up into four sections. About urination of a male dog. How can we explain the fact that the urination activities of a male dog often do not depend on the amount of urine in the bladder? I mean, we think the urge to urinate should depend on how much urine there is, right? Which would indicate how long he's been since he last urinated. And yet, a dog with almost no urine in the bladder will sometimes urinate. Why? Yeah, because that behavior has another function. Other than just getting rid of the urine.
They smell somebody else's mark.
Exactly. Another stimulus triggers it. Like another male dog entering his territory will trigger that behavior. He smells the other dog. He wants to mark his territory. It increases his drive to mark the other territory. So he'll lift his leg and try to urinate when he has almost no urine left.
So that would be considered a multi-purpose movement?
No. It's not quite. It's not multi-purpose. It's and in fact, the behavior is a little different from normal urination. There are differences. Not many, but differences. Certainly the situation where he does it, the height at which he urinates and so forth. He wants it to be right at the height of other dogs' noses. That's why they lift their leg and urinate on the tree and on the lamppost and so forth. Yes?
Sometimes when I go take my dog for a walk, he'll just lift his leg but nothing comes out.
That's an example of that. You see, the behavior was triggered. And so he goes through at least part of the action pattern, you see, whatever he can.
Like, he'll just pull it there and like, come on, go.
I know, exactly. So that's the point. This, in a sense, you could say that it's functioning like a multi-purpose action, but most multi-purpose actions have many more uses than just these two, as in the case of the dog. Okay, now I have a series of questions on chains of behavior and hierarchical systems. Do you remember the chain of behavior patterns shown by newborn kittens in nursing behavior? And I wrote this out for you, and I'll post this as a PDF file, but it's all right there in Lawrence, except he doesn't number them for you. He just has it all in a paragraph, and you have to pull it out. But it's a very clear sequence of behavior, as rigid as in the fish. Behavior we talked about before, and this is in a mammal, a higher mammal. The kitten, the newborn kitten, if he's awake and he's not suckling, shows a constant behavior pattern. He creeps forward and he's moving his head like this, you know, constantly. In fact, he moves not only his head but the whole front part of his body shifting. Okay, it's a kind of appetitive behavior, you see. But it's a very specific behavior pattern. If he touches anything, vertical, solid object, a book, your leg, whatever, you know, the kitten will snuggle up against it but keep moving. He'll now move right along it. Okay? So his behavior will be modified. Any contact with fur changes the stimulus. Okay? If it's fur, he'll stop his forward motion, okay? He'll continue those sweeping motions, but now his nose will be, he'll keep his nose pressed against the fur, and he'll continue these motions. If he touches a bare spot, and of course by making those motions, he will be moving around the furry surface, usually the mother, okay? If he touches a bare spot, which would correspond to the nipple area, he suddenly will cease the sweeping motions. Okay, and then he starts the snapping movements of the mouth. Okay. If he finds the teat, then he stops all the other movements and initiates suckling. But in addition, he not only initiates suckling, but he starts these rhythmic, along with the suckling, rhythmic forward movements of his mouth, his nose, pushing against the breast area, and milk treading with his feet, just gentle. Someone described that in the thing they wrote. You did, yeah. When they do this against the, it's gentle, it's to stimulate the breast, okay? And humans show very similar behavior. Just as innate, just as much a fixed action pattern in human babies. And the thing to note about, one special thing to note about that sequence is that each motor pattern serves as the appetitive behavior for the next fixed action pattern. Okay, but now the appetitive behavior, you see, is very specific and is an action pattern in itself. So such chains of behavior are very common. They were described by Tinbergen as examples of a hierarchical organization of instinct. That's what he called it. And he's depicted diagrammatically. His figures are often reproduced. I just want you to notice the difference from Lawrence's. The pictures I'm talking about are this one, where he shows a single motivational system that then elicits a number of different behaviors, okay, which themselves then are motivational systems. And each one of those has something blocking it. See, he's got the older view of the T stimuli, that they function to remove that block and let the behaviors happen. But you see, because he shows the hierarchy, and you see it more clearly in this picture, which is the one most often reproduced in textbooks, where he shows the whole hierarchy beginning with migration behavior. That's the one he has at the top, which leads then to territorial behavior of the animal, which then leads to the series of parental behavior, courting, nesting, fighting, and so forth that go with it, that you see commonly in birds. And then each of those has a sequence of behaviors that, in order to fulfill it. And of course, each of those behaviors at the level of the way the body's working initiates groups of muscles, or further down till you're to single motor neurons eliciting contraction in single muscles. And most of that hierarchy at the bottom comes from the drawings and theories of Paul Weiss, who developed a lot of that. But Weiss did not deal with the higher order behaviors that Tinbergen was dealing with. And Lawrence likes that a lot. And it's interesting that he presents it without ever strongly pointing out how his own view of instinctive behavior had changed a little bit when he was depicting it differently. But we already pointed out this model is pretty similar to Lawrence's original hydraulic model, just shown in a different way. People often prefer Tinbergen's because it seems more like neurons. And Lawrence's seems like a flush toilet, so people don't like it as much. But in fact, the Lawrence model explains more, at least if you can accept that type of analogous model. It's important to understand that hierarchical organization, and we know now that to a considerable degree that's represented in the hierarchical organization of neural networks. At the highest level, of we see behaviors represented in the forebrain. At lower levels, we see them represented in the midbrain and hindbrain, especially the hindbrain, at the lowest levels in the spinal cord. Now, in that section, when Lawrence is talking about hierarchies of organization, he discusses a study of the female digger wasp by Behrens. It's an old study published in 1956, and Lawrence devotes a number of pages quoting Behrens in his work. I just want to know from you, what's the major point he's making? Why does he spend all that time? I want you to read it and see. You'll see that the wasp can take care of like 4 or 5 different nests. You know, it'll visit them all in an organized way. It's not always easy to predict what the wasp will do next. And Behrens represented in a hierarchical structure that's similar to way Tinbergen did. The point is that you can explain the behavior completely without invoking any learning whatsoever, even though the behavior seems very adaptive and complex. It happens without any learning, okay? Other than, well, there's a little bit of learning. He has to remember where the nest is and things like that. The animal will learn that. But the sequence, how he makes the series of choices, on the motor side anyway, does not involve any learning. So as soon as you have this hierarchical structure and behaviors at the same level interact with each other, usually by mutual inhibition, you can predict. And there's fatigue when one of them occurs, so its tendency to be elicited will decrease. You can explain pretty complex sequences of behavior, and you can model it. And in your model, you don't have to invoke very much learning. You certainly don't have to invoke any learning on the motor side. And that's the point Lawrence is making in presenting Behrens' work. Okay, I had 2 more questions about the hierarchies. One is concerning the behavior of ducks and geese. Many of these birds, when they're looking for food, find it below the surface of the water, and if they're in shallow water, they find it on the bottom. So to get it, they have to suddenly put their head down, and when they do so in shallow water, their tail end is still sticking up. So they call it upending. The birds upend. So I want to know, in what abnormal circumstances would such birds be feeding for the sake of upending instead of upending for the sake of feeding? Because of what I just said, they're doing that behavior in order to feed, right? That's the normal situation. But in fact, you can get birds that will do the opposite. Yes.
You showed that when the birds had been fed on dry land to the point where they wouldn't eat anymore.
Right, so you feed them to satiation. These are tame birds, right? You're feeding with corn on the shore.
Yes. Found that if you threw the same corn in the water, that they would upend.
Right. They're all finished feeding. They're full. They're satiated. You give them the chance to do that upending behavior to get the corn. Then they'll go out and they'll eat more so they can upend. So it's an example of the independence of these extraction patterns. The motivation at one level in the hierarchy can become stronger than the motivation at the higher level, even though that normally isn't going to occur. It can occur, particularly in birds that are not in the wild. So it indicates the independence of they'll practically do the upending for its own sake. And there are many examples. We mentioned the birds, the cactus finch, for example, that you can be feeding it, it doesn't need to eat, but it's been deprived of its normal method of eating, of grabbing a cactus spine and using that spine as a tool to poke into little holes in the cactus and find food. If you give it the spine, it will eagerly go and poke in everything, whether it's getting any insects or not. It likes to do that, you know, and it's deprived of doing that. So that's similar to what these ducks and geese are doing. Okay, now he has, in relationship to these hierarchies, he has a little discussion there about invention of the head in evolution. He talks about how it was invented twice, in the insects and in the vertebrates. In his view, why did it have to be invented? I don't completely agree with it, but it's certainly a reason why it had to be invented. I think it's simplified, but yes?
He said it was to prevent incompatible motor patterns from being used to punish scientists.
Okay, so animals develop many fixed action patterns, and some of them are not compatible with each other. So in order to select, they had to develop a higher system. Now, in fact, you can do that without developing a higher system by making them mutually inhibitory. Okay? And so this higher system can act to select, but it can also act to make priority decisions on which should be done. And higher animals are doing this all the time. Different motivations may have almost the same strength, and yet a higher system will act, make a selection, and do one or the other. We always get a head of some sort, a head ganglion, I should say, a head of the nervous system, in animals that show forward locomotion. So I would say something that he doesn't say there, that as soon as you have forward locomotion, okay, there's a need for head receptors, separate head receptors. And those head receptors will go into the nearest part of the nervous system, which is now at the head end. So they go into what becomes enlarged. It leads to the enlargement. It's probably one of the initial reasons for the enlargement. But that's only one reason. The additional reasons are what Lawrence talks about. So inhibition is one of its major functions, but there are other functions too, like stimulus analysis, deciding between information coming from different senses, integrating it, and so forth. Many reasons. I talk a lot more about that in my other class, 914. He says that view of the head ganglion is thinking of the inhibition as a kind of bridle, like the bridle on the horse. But he says in higher animals, there's an additional function. It can act as the spur also. It can increase motivation. It can increase the likelihood that one will act rather than the other. So we act by both the spur and the bridle. All right. In the third section, spatial orientation, and also what his views of thinking in higher animals, explain how the mantle of reflexes, the term that we mentioned before from von Holst, tends to conceal the rigidity of fixed motor patterns. What is he talking about? And his example is, for example, in the egg rolling behavior of gulls, something that Tinbergen studied a lot. Well, if you see two gulls that have eggs that have rolled out of the nest, they roll it back in. The behavior's not identical in the two birds. So is this really a rigid fixed action pattern or not? What is it that makes for the differences? And that, in that case, it's pretty simple. Okay, it's orientation behavior. If the egg rolls a little bit to one side, it initiates action patterns that serve to orient the roll. Okay, but it's still fixed action patterns. It's the action patterns that don't involve orientation like that, orienting responses, that you see the greatest, the most obvious rigidity of fixed action patterns. For example, in the display behaviors, social displays, okay, that we've talked about a little bit already.